Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with actor, musician, musical director, playwright, David Lutkin. David is currently performing in Woody Says, which he wrote about the legendary, iconic Woody Guthrie. Listen to David talk about not only his life and how he became the complicated man he is, but also his passion to portray the real man, Woody Guthrie, not just the music we know. Stay tuned. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Is about being the person you really are. That is, about having access to every aspect of yourself that you came into this life with. As a psychotherapist, it seems clear to me that many of us are not doing that. Many of us are doing what I call living out a cover story. That is the truth about them, but it's not the whole truth about them. Many of us have had to leave behind or pretend or deny that some things that are true about us are not. And we get so good at it that we actually even forget that they were. So The Lynn Show is about saying, if this happened to you, it may not be too late to recover some of what you might have had to sacrifice to get through your childhood. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to really be who you are. They are, to use the psychotherapeutic term, congruent. What you see is what there is. And today, the person that I'm interviewing, David Lutkin, is a lovely example of that. You can hear David talk about how he evolved, somewhat slowly, but always moving towards what felt right to him, what he was meant to be. It's a long interview, and I want to play at least one song from the Woody Guthrie collection, because David is here in his show, what he says. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking now and let David talk for himself. But before I play David's interview, I'm going to play a cut from his CD, Woody Says, The Words, Music, and Spirit of Woody Guthrie. This is his version of Pastors of Plenty, which you will hear him talk about during the interview.
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hands is hold. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rolled, and your deserts was hot and your mountains was cold. Well, I've worked in your orchards of beeches and prunes. I've slept on the ground in the light of your moon, and on the edge of your cities you'll see us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind. California, Arizona, I make all your crops. Then it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops, and dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine, to set on your table at a light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from the Grand Coulee Dam where the waters run down. Migrants have been, and we'll work in this fight, and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble that river and I, all along your green valley I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it means, cause my pastures of plenty must always be.
So I'm here with David Lutkin, who is currently part of the ensemble company of Woody Says, appearing at the Oslo Repertory Theater. I was here on opening night, so it was wonderful, and you got quite a response.
Oh, yes. Well, they're very, very nice folks, all of the performances that we've had, and we're looking forward to the next 3 weeks or whatever we got left.
So when are you running to? Do you remember?
We run until June the 21st.
Okay. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it's clear that you're making your life, and at least at the moment, your living with the art of playing and singing, theater, music, performing. What do you call yourself?
Well, I guess I call myself an actor musician. I work as an actor and a musician at the same time. I also work as an actor, and I also work as a musician. And I also work sometimes as a music director and a director. I've done quite a few different things. But as you say, over the last, over the last 35 years, I have made my living in all of those various ways as something of an artist. I guess that always depends upon whom you ask.
No, I don't think it does, actually. I mean, I think you qualify, right?
Well, thank you very much. I'm asking you.
Yes,
that's good.
In my opinion, you definitely qualify.
Well, thanks.
So I only ask one question.
Sure.
And it is, do you remember, can you tell me, the very first moment in your life when any of this drew you, when you wanted to sing or dance or perform or act or get people to pay attention to you or...
Well, that's a very good question. And it's actually a little part of the show, which, of course, I put this show together in 2007 for the Edinburgh Festival. And I went back and forth with the director for quite some time over how exactly to start the show, because I had been asked by Harold Leventhal, Woody Guthrie's old manager, to write a biography of Woody Guthrie for the stage. And so that's what I was trying to do. But when it came to how to begin the show, the director had what I think was a very good idea, which was that rather than just playing Woody Guthrie on stage, I'm also playing myself And it starts with me explaining that I actually learned a few of these songs when I was about 3 in nursery school from an old teacher of mine who I had no idea at the time that she was a communist or progressive or whatever she was, back in Dallas, Texas in 1961 or so. But we learned quite a few Woody Guthrie songs and a bunch of Pete Seeger songs and you know, Go Tell Aunt Rhody the Old Grey Goose is Dead and all that kind of thing. And so I began to sing at a very early age. And another part of the long-winded answer to your question is that in about 1957, when right about when I was born, my father bought a mandolin from Sears and Roebuck, as he would say, for $17.50. And he learned how to play Shine Little Glow Worm and then put it up. And that was about as far as he ever got. But I have older brothers and a sister, and they all began to pick that instrument up, and then others that my parents bought and provided. And so all of my older siblings were playing music when I was 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and on through there. And so when I was about 7 or 8, somebody handed me the mandolin, and I began to play it. And we all sang in the choir and acted in plays and all that kind of thing, just as so many other children do, of course. But I guess my parents were always very encouraging about it all, and I was in the choir at my school, and the choir director was also an influential fellow. I don't know if he was a communist, but anyway, his name was James Livengood, and he was a great guy. He died very young, unfortunately. But he was very interested in the Anglican tradition and choral music. And so he took me in about 1970, I guess, to the Royal School of Church Music.
Well, wait, hold on. I want to back you up a little
bit. Sure, sure.
Yeah. I just want to see if I got this right. You come from a family that, I mean, I don't know whether it started with your father and the mandolin, or whether your mother and father were always sort of interested in music, but the family seems to have been really interested in music and interested in performing and excited about that, no?
Well, I guess it was more really that my mother and father were interested in whatever we were interested in. And all of us were musical and played various instruments. My mother and father, interestingly enough, were really not very musical.
They sang. Oh, they did sing.
But they were not, I mean, you know, we sang in church. And my mother had a very pretty voice, and my father did not. But he loved to sing. And gosh, there's all these many, many influences of many things. My father's mother, my grandmother, was a classical pianist who had played and studied in the conservatory at the IINC, which is now the Mississippi State College for Women. She learned to play the piano and was absolutely brilliant. I heard her many times played with orchestras and all kind of stuff. But she gave it all up to marry my grandfather and have children. So there are certainly musical influences, but they come from kind of random places. As I was saying, it's my teacher here, and my parents were my grandmother, and another teacher here, and then my brothers and sisters. We had a family band, you know, when I was 8, 9, 10, all the way through high school. We all played together.
Do you know why your older siblings started to play?
Well, I think probably because my oldest brother picked up the mandolin and began to play, and that would have been in about 1962, I imagine. And he discovered that he was very good at it. And in 1962, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, all through there, that was the folk scare of the 1960s, as we all know. So right then, he was, you know, from the outside, all of this music for which the mandolin was appropriate, or almost appropriate, was happening, and he could play it. And we also, as children, spent a great deal of time in North Carolina. We used to go to camp in North Carolina every summer. And of course, that's the one of the big homes of bluegrass music and Appalachian music. And the mandolin, of course, is entirely appropriate for that. And so all of these little things just sort of encouraged him along the way. And he still plays, not professionally, but he's a school teacher. And everything has come full circle. He's a school teacher. he's still hacking away out in Dallas, Texas, where I grew up.
Well, so it does seem kind of random, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's sort of in the genes from Grandma and Mom, who, you know the singing in the church thing, right?
Right, sure.
But this picking up the mandolin and simply playing it, I mean, that's everybody doesn't do that, you know.
Well, that's right, and that's why I think the biggest influence was probably the enthusiasm that my parents had for whatever it was that we all wanted to do.
Yeah.
My sister became a doctor, and my oldest brother is a school teacher, and my other brother is a timber framer.
Okay, all right, so, all right,
building.
Yeah.
So we do have kind of a wild variety of things going on.
Yes, you do, and nobody except Grandma, right, is a performer.
Well, well, now on my mother's side, apparently my great, I think it was my great-great uncle was a fiddler, but that was a long time back. A man named Green, I believe, was his name. In Mississippi. All of my people actually come from Mississippi and Louisiana and around there.
Okay, so what I'm curious about is, well, I think you answered it actually, that while your older siblings are, they like it, they're playing, they're singing,
sure.
And they're having a good time, you have a family band, everybody's enjoying
right.
it, things happened in your life that led you to this, as opposed to being a doctor or a teacher or a timber
framer,
right? Okay. So there was the teacher, right? And then now back to where you had already gone
right.
to the place where he took you to.
Oh, the Royal School of Church Music.
Yes, the Royal School of Churches.
Right.
So, how old are you then?
At that point, I guess I was 13.
13, very young.
And
so he heard you, and
that's right.
He was interested in your talent, in your voice,
yes.
right? Okay,
yes.
So he took you to I never heard of the Royal School of Churches, so you want to tell what that's about?
Well, the Royal School of Church Music is what it is, and it's been around for a long time, and it's a British thing, and it's has to do with the Anglican Church, and I was singing in the choir at my school, and the choir director, Mr. Livengood, wanted to attach the school to the Royal School of Church Music, the school in Dallas, Texas. And he did so, and one of the things that the Royal School of Church Music does for all of their folks all around the world is they do these summer programs where they bring together and put together these choirs and learn, you know, more about music and more about musical tradition and for fellows like my teacher to learn about conducting and how to choose, you know, things for voices and you know, the size of the building and all kind of things. And so I was there and had a terrific time with him. He was a great teacher and a great friend. And I guess what the angle of all of this towards what you're saying is that indeed it what sets me apart a little bit from my brothers and my sister is that I had a really good voice, not that they don't, but that I chose to pursue singing and acting as well in even junior high school and high school. Of course, lots of times in high school people do musical theater shows, and so I could sing, and so in addition to the as the people often say in folk music anyway, in addition to the sacred, we also had the profane.
That's right.
The theater.
Right. Okay, wait. So in junior high school, you auditioned?
I guess I did. In junior high school, it was probably a little bit more like I was, you know, picked. We're going to do this play, and you're going to play this guy.
Right, okay, and so in high school?
In high school, I imagine I auditioned for a couple of things, but I didn't really start actually having to audition until I got to college.
Well, okay, hold on. So sometime in this journey, are you thinking about this as a career?
Well, you know, that's a long time ago you asked that question. I don't really know when I began to think of this as a career. I think it kind of was an evolving decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I first did, I acted in plays when I was in junior high school and high school and college. But by the time I was in college, I was already making money playing music. In pizza joints and you know, fraternity parties and things like that. And ironically enough, we all were in college relatively close to one another. My sister and my timber framer brother were still in the same neighborhood as I. My sister and I both went to Duke University, and my brother went to the University of North Carolina. And so we were all still pretty close together, and we started playing music because we'd always played music, and now we could make money playing music, so we started playing music. And then they left, and I continued with my roommate in college.
What are you majoring in college?
I majored in Greek.
I see. And what did you think you were going to do with Greek?
Well, to get back to my old man, when I went off to college, and I had, in addition to music and quite a few other things, in junior high school and high school, I had taken Latin and Greek all the way through. And the teacher, who's another very influential person in my life, whose name was Michael Bennett, interestingly enough, he was an actor.
Ah.
And he was my Latin and Greek teacher. And he was a professional actor in Dallas, Texas. And so I was pretty good at languages when I got to college, I started off doing different things, but I decided that I was going to major in classics, actually classical studies. But the main thing that I studied was Greek. and my dad said to me that whatever you take when you get up there, whatever you decide you want to do, you do the hardest thing they got. And I said, all right. But I don't think that he ever advised me, nor did I ever think that I was going to college to study something that would get me a job, that what I was going to college to do was to get an education.
What an original concept.
And that whatever that education was, particularly if you took the hardest thing they had, that then you would be well prepared for pretty much whatever you did.
Yeah, it would serve you.
Right.
Right?
Yes. So I did, actually. I studied in Rome for a semester, studying classics and Latin and Greek and all that stuff. And I did teach Italian for a little while when I was living in Colorado. I had a good time while I was playing music at night.
Well, all right, okay. So you go through college studying the classics and Greek and playing music and making a living. Are you thinking about being an actor? Is there any acting training or any of that?
Well, I came to know pretty quick in the late 1970s and the early 1980s that what I did best, I'm a reasonably good guitar player. I'm not a great guitar player. I'm okay. I'm a pretty good singer when my voice is in good shape. But what I really ended up, the act that I had, which of course I was making up every night, I didn't have anybody writing things for me. I did write a few songs. I made a couple of record albums. As I often say, all of my albums have gone vinyl. They're real collector's items if you can find them. Now, not the recent stuff, not the CD of this stuff.
Right,
but anyway,
I
discovered that what I really did best, because my act was a little sort of vaudeville-esque, I guess, because of a lot of storytelling and a lot of making up songs on the spot or lampooning other popular songs or whatever it was, and taking a lot of requests from the audience and making the audience do things and all that kind of stuff, was what I sort of grew to do.
What do you call that?
Gosh, I really don't know what to call it, but I can tell you what it actually is. It's selling beer. That's what it really is. But I had a very good time, and I did pretty well, and I lived in a whole bunch of different places doing it. I lived in Connecticut. I lived in Texas for a while. I lived in Colorado. I lived in New York. And had a great time at all those places. But finally, once again, my father came to me and said, I think in a kind of a, gosh, I don't know, what shall I say, a prescient way, I guess, that he kind of agreed with me. I had begun to think that the best thing I did was actually performing. I was not a great songwriter, I was not a great guitar player, I was not the best singer, but I was a pretty good performer.
Yeah.
And as you saw, I guess, on the opening night or the preview night, that's an awful lot of what I do.
Yeah.
Is I describe it to my nieces, the Timber Framers children, when they were little, as playing the guitar and talking to the audience. That's what I do.
And it's clear, actually, that although this is clearly scripted, you are never completely scripted. Am I wrong about that?
You are right about that. That's very true.
Mm-hmm. And charming, of course. You're exactly right. It's lovely, and you were smart to recognize that that's a skill.
So my father said to me, he said, you know, if you're going to make your living on the stage, maybe you ought to learn something about it.
Oh, what a smart man your father is.
So there you go. So he convinced me of something that I was already headed towards, which was to go back to school, to go to acting school. And since I had acted in junior high school and high school, and I had done this music stuff that was great fun, but playing in bars, the benefits are pretty bad. And you get a lot of pizza and a lot of
beer.
Beer. That's about it. And but I had a wonderful time, but I decided to go to acting school. And so when I got ready to go to acting school, I went back to thinking about the original pieces of inspiration for the performing part of my life or world or whatever you want to call it. And I decided that I wanted to go to acting school in England because I really think that they are the best at it as far as Shakespeare and all of those, the things that have grown from that. unless, of course, you go to Russia and study with Mr. Stanislavski, and that's you can't do. So I decided to go to England, and so I happened to be in New York at the time, and to make a long story short, I went to audition for the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, the Central Academy, and the Webber Douglas Academy. And when I went in to audition on the first for the Royal Academy, it was at the United Nations that I went to audition, and I wore a tie, and I hadn't been in a play in a long time. And I decided that I had to do a classical thing and a modern thing, and I had to sing a song. So the song I wasn't worried about. And the modern thing, I think I did something from an old thing called Beyond the Fringe.
Oh, my.
Yes. But for the classical thing, I decided, because that was what I was the most nervous about, I would do Friends, Romans, and Countrymen, because I thought it was so hackneyed that nobody else would do it. And so I did my speech for the Royal Academy, and they said, thank you very much. And they asked me, how do you plan to pay for your time if you come over to England? And where I come from, that's kind of a rude question. And so I said, well, gosh, I kind of stumbled around and fumbled out an answer. And sure enough, the next day I came and auditioned for the Central Academy, and they asked me the same thing. And I think I had a little better answer, and then I auditioned for the Webber Douglas Academy of Dramatic Arts, and they said, how do you plan to pay for your time abroad? And I said, in cash. And they said, sign here. So that's how I got into acting school. So I went over there for a couple of years and had a wonderful time, and while I was there, I made money by playing music in bars, playing American folk music and rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. And that is why, 20, 30 years later, when I wrote Woody Says, we went to Scotland, to the Edinburgh Festival, first. Because I knew the appreciation of this kind of music is actually much deeper in Europe and the United Kingdom than it is in the United States in the world of theater, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, okay, so now talk about Woody Says, how it happened, what it is, what people can expect, all that.
Well, Woody Says, I think I mentioned old Mr. Leventhal at the beginning of our talk. I did a show about Woody Guthrie back in 1988, not too long after I got back from London. And at that time, I became friends with Woody's old manager, Harold Leventhal. And there are quite a few shows about Woody Guthrie out there and about his music and his life and times kind of thing. But Mr. Leventhal told me in about 2001, I guess, that what he really wanted to see sometime was for somebody to do a show that was really a biography of Woody Guthrie. That a lot of the shows, they were wonderful things. They're all great. They're all still out there. There's one called Bound to Glory, there's one called California to the New York Island, and Woody Guthrie's American Song, and This Land is Your Land, and a whole bunch of them, and I've done most of them at one time or another. But the thing about them all is that they're mostly about the music and the inspirations for the music, and the political roots of the songs and the poetry. And what Mr. Leventhal wanted me to do, and what I have tried to do, is to take Woody's own writings and put together, so I didn't really write it, I wrote a lot of it, but not, I'm writing around what Woody wrote about himself, to try to show to the theater audience more about the life of the man, Woody Guthrie, to make that a backdrop and a something of a fabric from which the music and the poetry come. Because I think Mr. Leventhal was right about this, that the more you know about Woody Guthrie, the more and profound the music is. Because amazing and profound as it already is, when good old Mrs. Eichmeier taught it to me when I was three, and we learned Pastures of Plenty, any little three-year-olds singing, My Land I'll Defend with My Life if Need Be, because my pastures of plenty must always be three, be free, three. And that, certainly I knew what that meant, but I didn't really know what it meant.
Right.
When you know more about the fact that Woody Guthrie wrote that song, in 1941, when he was commissioned by the Bonneville Power Administration to write songs about the Grand Coulee Dam, and what they were looking for was some sort of jingoistic songs about how great America is in the Bonneville Power Administration. And there, he wrote a whole bunch of songs for them that are this very famous little period of his life. They're incredibly prolific and wonderful songs. But a song like Pastures of Plenty, coming out of that, is there's another layer or level to it when the lyrics say, my pastures of plenty must always be free, which of course indicates that there is some threat to that. And of course at the time, what everybody immediately thinks is that it's World War II, and yes, it is World War II in 1941, but at the time he wrote it, the United States was not in World War II. And when you further learn that his life up to that time was just this incredible whirlwind of ups and downs and
catastrophe.
That's right. Really? Crazy things and catastrophes, as you say. And that it's such an amazing set of circumstances to me that he wrote that song. He had been paid a lot of money. He had his wife and children with him. And his car was repossessed, and his wife left him, took children, went back home. And he, because he was being an irresponsible bonehead about a lot of other aspects of what was going on in his life, given the fact that so many difficult things had happened to him, and perhaps bonehead is the wrong word, but he behaved badly in several circumstances, which led to these reversals of his fortunes and his family's fortunes. And the fact that all of that is part of Pastures of Plenty, even just his, you know, the personal things about he wasn't making the payments on his car, to me, if you, the more of those things you know,
the more remarkable it is.
The more remarkable it is.
Oh, that's yeah, there's right. No question about
yes.
it.
And that's what Mr. Leventhal was looking for, and I hope that I have accomplished.
You have definitely accomplished it. And the because that's exactly what I took away from it, how extraordinary it is, you know?
Well, he was an amazing guy.
He was an amazing guy.
And,
you know, when you say, you know, that he was a bonehead and he wasn't paying his debt, you know, but the other thing that he was doing, which is so extraordinary to me, is that, you know, they were paying him for this, but he wasn't doing that. He was writing from his heart.
That's
he was
right.
He was always true in his art to himself, to his vision, right?
That's right. Yes.
Whatever it cost him.
Yep.
Right? I have
so.
Tears in my eyes, you know.
That's very true, though. He couldn't ever, it would never have occurred to him
to pander.
That's correct, and that's why, you know, the famous thing that I also mention and a lot of people know, of course, is that even the song This Land Is Your Land is not what it seems to be most of the time. When I was a little boy, I learned This Land Is Your Land with the three or maybe four sort of regular verses, and we don't, very many of us, learn the other three verses. Of course, there are actually more than that. But he first sat down and wrote six verses to the song, and then he wrote some others. And other people have written complete other versions of the song. In fact, a fellow from Sarasota sent me one just the other day. He wrote that song about, you know, from California to the New York Island, from the, you know, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, and all that kind of stuff. And it's beautiful, and it's a wonderful song, and it's all about how wonderful America is, but it's also about, if you read the original verses, it's a response to God Bless America, with the, you know, from the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam and all that kind of stuff. So he was directly comparing things as he went along, and then his song is very purposefully, he couldn't do it. And of course, with this particular one, he set out to not really parody or lampoon, I don't think, but just write something that could be set up next to God Bless America that he believed was a much more accurate picture of what was going on than God Bless America. Nothing against Irving Berlin from me. Woody was not a big fan, but he wanted people not to depend upon God and that everything was going to be fine because God blessed America and America's the greatest place in the world. He said, yes, America is the greatest place in the world, but as, a little bit like Winston Churchill saying democracy is the worst system of government there is except for all the rest. Woody was saying America, yes, America is the greatest place in the world, but only because the world's a pretty rough place right now, and we got to watch out because people are lining up to, you know, on soup kitchens and all these other kinds of things, and we have to take care of each other. We can't just say...
And remember, this land is your land.
That's right. That's right. We can't exclude people, and we must take care of one another, and we can't just say, here we are in our island nation, and God bless America, and everybody else go home, and everything's great for us, you know.
Right.
And so that's, you know, even in all of his songs, that's what he's after. My favorite Woody Guthrie song is the song Pretty Boy Floyd, which is not in the show. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find a place for it in
the show.
Do you
have a copy of it? Did you give
well,
me?
I can sing it for you.
Okay.
Oh, well, okay. All right. I just, the songs that I chose for the show...
opening guitar case.
Yes. are songs that I chose for many reasons. Some of it was just to illustrate Woody's writing technique, but a lot of it was to illustrate what was going on in his life at that time, which he wrote about directly or indirectly with songs. And I just couldn't find a place for Pretty Boy Floyd. But I think it's one of his, I think it's his greatest song. And I'll do a little truncated version here. And since it's a two-show day, I'll sing it in a lower key. Gather round me children, the story I will tell. Pretty boy Floyd the outlaw, Oklahoma doing well. In the town of Shawnee on a Saturday afternoon, wife beside him in the wagon. He's in the town they rode. A deputy sheriff approached them in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of language, and his wife he overheard. Now pretty boy grabbed a log chain and the deputy grabbed a gun. Then the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. Yes, but he took to the trees and the timber, lived a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. Yes, he took to the trees and the timber to the Canadian River shore. Yeah, pretty boy found a welcome many a farmer's door. Some tell about a stranger who come to beg a meal, and underneath his napkin he left $1,000 bill. Others tell of many a starving farmer, the same old story's told. Yeah, pretty boy paid the mortgage, saved their little home. Oklahoma City was on a Christmas day, come a boxcar load of groceries with a letter that did say, now you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Well, here's a Christmas dinner for all the families on relief. Through this world I ramble, I see lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun, some with a fountain pen. Through this world you ramble, and through this world you roam. You won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home. Gather round me children, and a story I will tell. Pretty boy Floyd the outlaw, Oklahoma knew him
well. Wow. Oh, it's so beautiful.
It's such a great song, and really I think the greatest, pithiest little lines that he ever wrote, you know, and one of his most famous that says, through this world I ramble, I see lots of funny men, some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. And that's, you know, that kind of got, I got the goosebumps just thinking about it, because that to me, I mean, that's even better than, you know, my land I'll defend with my life if need be, because that kind of gets to the
The heart of the matter.
The root of everything, even beyond the politics and even beyond the everything, that's what it is. It's that, you know, not only is the pen mightier than the sword, but you better watch out.
Yes.
Because people are people, and we have to watch out for each other, you know. Look out for each other. And that was his, you know, his raison d'etre for his whole life was not only trying to point out the people who were doing wrong, but trying to show everybody ways to look out for one another.
Yeah. One of the things that was so powerful and poignant for me in the play was which of course I didn't know, was the personal pain, the personal losses. And, you know, to have continued to, create in the face of that.
Yes. Well, Woody had a rough time, that's for sure. Now, of course, he died of Huntington's disease in 1967 at the age of 55.
Well, and he got it. I mean, he had such a short time to create all this stuff. My God.
So that's not only did he was born in 1912, he died in 1967, so his life was short already. But it was shortened on the far end by the fact that the last 10, 12, 13 years, even really 15 years of his life, from about 1953 or so, he really was almost incapacitated. Of course, it was a progressive thing, but and on the front end of his life, mm-hmm. He was brought up in rural Oklahoma and moved to Pampa, Texas, where he began to play music in a little band there and played on the radio in Pampa, and then moved to California in 30s. I guess he first went out there in 1937, 36, sorry, I can't remember everything. So his really productive period, which of course World War II is in the middle of things too, when he was in the Merchant Marine, his really productive period was about 15 years, from about 1935 until 1950. And within that, he wrote thousands of songs, first of all, and different types and styles. And so it, in a way, it was an incredibly intense sort of tide of creativity against the, you know, the 15 years in the middle of his life, against the 20 years on this side and 20 years on this side, that were, for one reason or another, he was disallowed from,
right.
You know, from this, from the creative intensity, removed from it, that took up the middle of his life. So I've always thought that his character and his poetic abilities, which one of the reasons, going back to the fact that I majored in Greek, one of the things that attracted me to Mr. Guthrie, since I know, you know, not hundreds, but dozens, anyway, of other folk singers' songs, and they're all great, you know, Uncle Dave Macon and Lead Belly and Pete Seeger and the Carter family and all those people, they're all fabulous. And they've all got their own shows now, too, almost all of them. But the thing about Woody was this
Greek tragedy.
Extemporaneous, well, it was two things. It was the Greek tragedy, certainly, but it was also his abilities as a poet to compose extemporaneously, which I also did, sort of coincidentally. He did his talking blues, and he would make up songs on the spot and all that kind of thing, just the way Virgil and the epic poets, Homer and but Virgil we know, and Ovid and people like that, they would hold court every day and they would sit and strum the lyre and they would speak in iambic hexameter, and just make it up as they went along, just like rap music today. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that Woody did quite often, and that's the kind of thing that, to me, begins to sort of pull everything together.
You are the only person, really, who could have appreciated it in the way that you do.
Well, that's I will certainly say that.
No,
that,
I think it's very clear. All those influences that are special to you.
Right.
It's great.
They just all focus on this work.
For Mr. Leventhal.
That's right.
Recognizing it and causing you to create this thing, which is extraordinary. And I'm going to stop you because I've already made you run over. And
uh-oh.
As he said, he has two shows today, and we're already 11 minutes over, and I could talk to you all day long.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Oh, no, you're charming, and you have a lot to say, and everything you say is interesting.
Gee. I don't think anybody's ever said that about me before, but thank you very, very much.
But they thought it. Even if they didn't get around to saying it, they certainly thought it. So I just will say thank you very much, David.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Had a great time.
Oh, me too. Well, I guess you can hear what I hoped you would hear, and that is David is somebody who is completely connected to who he is, even though who he is a little unconventional. And maybe you, too, are a little unconventional, but maybe you haven't had the permission that David had from his father, from his mother, from his family, from his teachers, to really explore himself, to be who he really is. Would that we all had parents who simply wanted to encourage us to do whatever it was we were interested in doing. But if you didn't have that, and if you think that you were in some ways cheated from something significant and important to you, and you want to talk about that, you can reach me at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. You can click on the link that says email me. You can ask me any questions that you have. You can get me to come and speak to your group or organization. You can get a copy of my book. When you can, you will. Why you can't always do what you want to do and what to do about it. But now let me say that, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that intrigued you or interested you or tickled you or informed you. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too. I believe we have enough time to go out on the maybe the best known Woody Guthrie song, This Land Is Your Land.
Woody said, unless we do hear the work songs and war songs and love songs and dance songs of all the people everywhere, we're most apt to lose the peace and this world along with it. Nobody living can ever stop me as I go walking my freedom highway. Nobody living can make me turn back. This land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California Island, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you and me. Well, I'm roaming in a ramble, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert, and all around me voices sounded saying, this land was made for you and me. This land is yours.
older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten